Welcome, I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar, and this is the Your Call Media Roundtable. On Wednesday, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon opened the UN General Assembly with an address that can only be called bleak. Said Ban, it has been a terrible year for the principles of the United Nations Charter. From barrel bombs to beheadings, from the deliberate starvation of civilians to the assault on hospitals, UN shelters and aid convoys, human rights and the rule of law are under attack. He continued to say, "Our hearts and minds are made heavy by unspeakable acts and the deaths of innocents. Cold War ghosts have returned to haunt our times. We have seen so much of the Arab Spring go violently wrong." And indeed, with airstrikes in Iraq and Syria, the U.S. returned to war in the Middle East this week and apparently allied itself with some of the most anti-democratic forces in the region. But is this really a more troubled world, or do we simply have more access to the information and images of the worst of what humanity is doing to itself and the planet? In the face of global crises, should we find hope in the more than 300,000 protesters who took to the streets of New York City last Sunday to demand action to stop global warming? And while some stories, Ukraine, the battle against Islamic State, get a lot of attention, are there equally pressing crises in corners of the world that the international news media has less interest in? It's a week for the big picture on the Media Roundtable, and we have some great thinkers on board for the discussion. Suzanne Goldenberg is U.S. environment correspondent for The Guardian. She joins us from New York, where she has spent the week covering the U.N. Climate Summit and the People's Climate March. Suzanne, so good to have you with us.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and also with us from New York is Jonathan Landay. He's a national security intelligence reporter for McClatchy Newspapers. And I always want to point out, one of the only mainstream American reporters who called the Bush administration on its misinformation in the lead up to the Iraq war. So, Jonathan, great to have you with us as always.
Good to be here, too.
And later in the hour, we're going to be joined by Borzu Dargahi. He's a Middle East correspondent for the Financial Times. He's been covering the U.S. strikes on Islamic State in Iraq and Syria from Baghdad. He'll be with us in the second half hour. We always begin our Friday Media Roundtable with examples of excellent or compelling journalism from the week. Suzanne Goldenberg from The Guardian, is there a piece of journalism this week you'd recommend that our listeners check out?
Yes, I mean, there's two pieces, and these are not traditional pieces of journalism. They are interactive graphics that appeared in The Guardian and in the New York Times that get to the depths of the climate crisis. The one in The Guardian that I'm most proud of shows you the amount of emissions and carbon pollution produced by each country around the world. So that's very interesting to see because you can see who is responsible for what. And that's been getting a lot of mileage on our site. On the same theme, the New York Times has a graphic showing which countries are most endangered by sea level rise and where people are in the most danger. And as you'd expect, countries in Asia are in a great deal of danger, but also right here in the United States, there's about 3 million people who are threatened by sea level rise in the coming years and decades.
Well, maybe just take a moment, since obviously we can't show folks these interactive graphics on the air, to talk a little bit about particularly the first one you're talking about, who's responsible for what amount of greenhouse emissions and therefore the threat of global warming. What are some of the key things that pop out when you do look at this interactive graphic?
Well, if you look at this over history, the United States and Europe are the biggest sort of contributors to carbon pollution. You know, they're historically the ones that got us into the trouble we're in. But if you look more recently and if you look going forward, then it's going to be the emerging economies, China, India, Brazil, and countries like Canada, Australia, and Russia are responsible for a large and increasing share of the problem.
Suzanne, thanks for that recommendation. Jonathan Landay from the McClatchy News Group, what's a piece of reporting you encountered this week that impressed you?
So I'm going to toot our own horn this week. We have a great crew of reporters in the Iraq, Syria, Turkey region. And after the beginning of the U.S. airstrikes in Syria earlier this week, two of our reporters reached in to Syria to get reactions to these strikes by anti-Syrian rebels on the ground and produced a story that basically said they're extremely angry at the strikes, which, you know, on the face of it would sound kind of counterintuitive. But they pointed out that these strikes not only targeted the Islamic State, but also targeted Jabhat al-Nusra, which is the official al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria. But they're angry that they did this because Jabhat al-Nusra actually happens to be probably the most effective fighting force against, other than the Islamic State, against the Assad regime. This is and they are aligned with some of the groups that the United States is backing. And these groups are angry because they see these strikes against Jabhat al-Nusra as hurting their ability to fight Assad. And I just thought it was a really good piece because it kind of introduced us to this theme that is counterintuitive and yet was hugely informative.
Well, it's really, I mean, it seems counterintuitive, but part of it's just showing how incredibly complex the alliances around actions on both sides here, or what's happening in Syria and Iraq right now, are, right?
Absolutely. I mean, the whole dynamic, whether it's sectarian, political, religious, in that part of the world as a result of the civil war in Syria, and then this offensive that the Islamic State launched in Iraq beginning in mid-June, has just turned all of these alliances and enmities kind of on their head. So just an illustration, you have Iran and the United States, which have been at loggerheads since 1979, since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, and in particular over Iran's nuclear program, aligned together behind the new Iraqi government of Prime Minister Abadi. And indeed, we saw even what appeared to be cooperation between the United States and the Iranians in ending the Islamic State siege of a town of minority Turkmen in Iraq called Amerli, where you had these Iranian-backed, Iranian-trained Shiite militia on the ground, and you had the United States Air Force in the air bombing the Islamic State. But then when you go across the border into Syria, you have an exact opposite situation, where you have the United States, which is demanding the ouster of President Bashar Assad in any kind of political settlement, and Iran being Bashar al-Assad's main foreign backer, and indeed having sent not just military advisors, but there are Islamic Revolutionary Guard in there, and the Iranian proxy militia Hezbollah from Lebanon fighting on behalf of the Assad regime. And now you have the United States building, as part of this plan to go after, and at least in the president's word, degrade and eventually destroy the Islamic State, building a quote-unquote moderate, vetted opposition group to fight the Islamic State. But then eventually, there's very little doubt that if that part succeeds, and there are big questions about that, that this U.S.-created group will eventually go after Assad. So it is just an absolute mess and incredibly hard to understand.
Jonathan Lande, we'll definitely talk more about the complexities of that situation when we have Borzer Dargahi from the Financial Times on with us from Baghdad in about 15 minutes. And I want to thank you for the kudos as well. You can find links to all the stories that are recommended on the roundtable, as well as reporting from our guests, at our website, yourcallradio.org. Suzanne Goldenberg with The Guardian, you, of course, on Sunday were covering the People's Climate March, which, you know, I think amazed people just in its scale, right? We're talking about the largest, the biggest march since the anti-war protests leading up to the invasion of Iraq. So just its scale is a big story. But having been there and covered it, what were the stories beyond just, you know, just the impact of having that many people in the streets in one of the world's major cities when the UN climate summit was about to begin? What else would you really highlight in terms of why this matters as a story?
Well, I want to go back to that march, because as a journalist, one does tend to get really cynical and say, oh, Lord, another demonstration. But what was really striking to me is the way in which so many leaders referenced the bodies in the streets in their speeches at the UN Climate Summit. Now, so this is an event that had 120 heads of state, prime ministers and presidents, talking about climate change. The first time that this kind of gathering has been held in 5 years, which means that a lot of people in the room at the UN General Assembly had never really had to make a speech about climate before and had never really had to focus on it before. So they were forced to focus on this issue for the first time, and they were forced in part to acknowledge that there's a big public upswelling there, a popular opinion that wants them to deal with climate change. So I was struck by the fact that many of them talked about the will of the people, if you like, coming out of the streets, and that many of them made the point of saying, as did Barack Obama and others, that, you know, there are a lot of urgent, pressing issues in the world, such as Ebola, such as ISIS, but if we are going to look at the one that's an existential threat to all of us, that's climate change. So I thought that moment where people took a long-term view was very interesting. The other sort of takeaway from that I got was a sad one. So those are two, you know, sort of optimistic things. The sort of takeaway, though, is, you know, that this was, again, an occasion where there was a lot of talk, that these leaders didn't have to put on the table what they were actually going to do, and there wasn't a lot of specifics coming out from that. What was striking to me is the degree to which popular opinion and business has come out in front of leaders on this issue, and there's a lot more happening on the sidelines of that climate summit than was happening inside the chamber of the General Assembly.
Yeah, there are a lot of people who drew contrast between the 2009 UN Climate Summit, where there are a lot more kind of binding, you know, at least commitments to binding agreements by governments, whereas this time it was a lot more talking about what the private sector might do and a lot fewer binding agreements or binding commitments coming from governments. When you look at what it might take to actually turn this around, and right now it's a very short term we're talking about in terms of what scientists are saying in terms of the tipping point for global warming, where it won't be possible to not have really major increases. Does that seem to you hopeful in that the private sector has to be involved in some really powerful way? Or is the fact that there doesn't seem to be that kind of commitment from governments, even with this short-term deadline, where would you put the balance there?
Well, I think it's important to point out that governments don't have to put their commitments on the table right now. So, of course, they're going to wait to the last possible moment. But what you saw at this meeting, which is important, is that they all said that they're going to come forward by the deadline, which is March next year. And they've all reiterated that they're going to come to the table with their climate commitments. And a number of countries said, look, we're coming up with something really tough. We know, for example, that the European Union is talking about a 40% cut. We had Barack Obama saying, you know, we're going to step up to the plate. We had China saying our emissions are going to peak, although they're not saying when. So countries are gearing up to do something by that deadline. They weren't prepared to do it this week, which is fine. So I think we're still in a window here, 15 months, where they could really begin to act and take decisive action. I think it's very important that business is coming on board here. But I think it's also really important that people realize that you cannot leave this to business alone, because they will only do what's in their financial interest. And while there were a large number of businesses there saying, yes, they're going to act on climate change, I think the majority of world business is still not on board. And in fact, you know, we've got Siemens, for example, saying, you know, they're going to be burning coal for some time to come.
Jonathan Lande, I mean, you're a national security correspondent. There have been times in the climate debate where there's been an attempt to say, you know, global warming, this is a national security threat. And certainly the Pentagon has come out with certain reports about how it might have an impact on global security. But, I mean, is this something that, you know, in the world that you cover, that those folks are really paying close attention to?
Oh, absolutely. I think very much so. You've had these efforts going on by, I believe, either the Navy or the Air Force to develop new fuels that they will be able to depend on that don't produce the kind of greenhouse gases that are currently, climate problem. And there are units within the intelligence community now that track these problems. You've had a series of reports over the last several years, actually, from the National Intelligence Council, which is kind of the top U.S. Intelligence kind of think tank, which look at the world. I'm trying to remember when exactly these reports began. I think it began 2020, 2025, 2030, looking out years. And the problems attendant to climate change, shortages of drinking water, the shortages of resources are very much covered in these reports. And you continually hear, where you have these annual threat assessments where you have the heads of the intelligence community come out and testify publicly to Congress about, where they see the threats to the United States. And increasingly over the years, you've heard warnings about conflicts increasingly over resources, over dwindling resources, a lot of which is caused by global warming.
And Suzanne, you were talking about how when it comes to there's this upsurge of kind of popular concern about this, popular upset, and certainly in the streets of New York, there were also some similar protests in Europe, some in South America. But it seems like when you're talking about that, where the current increase in emissions is coming from, places like China, India, Brazil, I mean, those governments may not feel like that's really such a big deal, right?
Well, the Chinese government for sure feels it's a really big deal. I mean, they have been taking a lot of action recently on this, because what's also happened in China is that the burning of coal, which they burn to run their economy, is also causing people health problems. So it's causing air pollution right now at the same time as it's sort of...
And there is popular unrest about that.
To be honest. So fixing the problem is a two-for. They make their cities healthier, and they help prevent the sort of catastrophic climate change that, could be upon all of us.
So now India, so I know that they're a country who's kind of said, right now we're not committing to decreasing emissions. We're going to continue to focus on growth.
But you have to look at what the Indians are saying,
which
is, not... It's not so clear. They are saying we're not going to cut our emissions absolutely now. But then the second line, they say, look, we're going to adopt a less polluting course of growth. And that's important. It's also important that India is scrambling all the time for sources of energy to run its economy. The country always has energy shortages. It's got perennial blackouts. And so you have the current prime minister comes from a state that was really forward-looking in installing solar power. India is very interested in solar energy. The coal that it has in the country is very dirty, very inefficient. It doesn't want to be spending foreign exchange on importing energy. So it's looking very seriously at wind and solar.
That's fascinating. That's Suzanne Goldenberg. She's a U.S. environment correspondent for The Guardian. Also with us is Jonathan Landay, national security correspondent for the McClatchy Newspaper Group. I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar here on the Media Roundtable. As always, we welcome your calls and emails at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255, or you can email feedback@yourcallradio.org. If you have examples of really well-reported journalism from this week or places where you feel the news media has fallen down, we would love to hear your perspective. Once again, 866-798-TALK. And in the second half hour, we're going to be joined by Borzu Dargahi of the Financial Times, who is in Baghdad. So if you've been paying attention to coverage of U.S. airstrikes in Iraq and Syria and you have questions or you have comments, we'd love to have you join in then. Jonathan, I wanted to ask you, as someone, as you're paying attention to the General Assembly while you're also following what's happening in the Middle East, what, the UN General Assembly, it's just this kind of opportunity to look at all kinds of different terrible things happening in the world or efforts to counter them. Are there any stories that are a little off the beaten path of what's kind of getting front page coverage about the UN General Assembly, conversations going on there that you think we might want to be paying more attention to?
I think there are all sorts of conversations that go on at the UN General Assembly, the opening of it, that are really important, that may get dragged down by rhetoric, by perhaps issue exhaustion, as I like to call it, but that are incredibly important. You know, there's a discussions on Africa and the problems facing Africa on the sidelines of this year's debate. There's discussions and a conference on, I believe, world hunger and how do we get to zero hunger, which is a great goal, but I guess we all know is a little bit is not really within reach. But nevertheless, the idea that there are these discussions that are looking at potential solutions, are keeping these issues fresh. You know, one of the problems, of course, is that we, as at least in the newspaper industry, and to a certain extent broadcast, but certainly in the newspaper industry, have gone through our own incredible economic contraction, which has reduced the number of reporters, which reduces our ability to cover some of these events, and we have to figure out which ones we're going to have to concentrate on and ones that we're not going to be able to focus on. And unfortunately, some of these discussions that I was just talking about are ones that we can't and certainly don't have the resources to be able to cover, and yet are really incredibly important. You know, a lot of people look at the UN as being this international talk shop that doesn't do much. But, you know, at least as far as I'm concerned, the ability to keep these issues, very crucial issues, alive within the agenda of the world's powers, I think is really, really important. Because without the UN, I don't think we would be having the focus on some of these issues that really do need to be kept alive in the public sphere.
Suzanne Goldenberg, I know you're going to have to leave us in a couple of minutes. Maybe you could talk about it as you've covered. I mean, great information you've given us both about the climate summit and the march, the People's Climate March on Sunday. But anything else that's really struck you in the General Assembly, the tone of it, or any of the particular conversations you've been hearing about?
I've been sort of all climate all the time that I've been looking at, I have to say.
Angles of that you'd say, hey, here's one thing you might not know about, you want to know about when it comes to the climate discussions.
Oh, okay. I think, you know, I do think that I was very struck by the fact that both Barack Obama, John Kerry, and some other leaders made a point of saying, Ban Ki-moon, that they made a point of saying that they listen to the people on this issue, that they, you know, they're going to respond to people marching in the streets. I can't remember the last time that I heard so many leaders say that, really. And I think also one point I wanted to make about the climate demonstration, why I think it was so effective, both in getting the numbers and in the impact that it made, is that it was one of the most diverse assemblies of people that I have ever seen. So you didn't just have the traditional Greens coming out, and you had African Americans, you had Latinos, you had, you know, moms pushing their strollers down from the Upper West Side, you had indigenous peoples. It was really astonishing to me that the diversity of that crowd, and I think that's a really good thing, because I think if you leave the issue of climate change just to relatively small environmental organizations, then, it will remain a marginalized issue. The fact that so many people got involved, I think, is encouraging in terms of finding a solution.
Suzanne Goldenberg with The Guardian, thank you so much for being with us here on the Media Roundtable, and hope to have you back soon.
Thank you.
I'm Matt Martin, sitting in for Rose Aguilar. We will be back with more of the Media Roundtable after this.
Today's conversation on Your Call on the phone. It's 866-798-8255. Toll free, 866-798-TALK. Or you can send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11, we have a special presentation for you. Hidden Kitchens World. Stay tuned.
those of you joining us now, I'm Matt Martin in for Rose Aguilar, and this is the Your Call Media Roundtable. We are podcasting our show. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also send us emails if you have ideas for future shows, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up next week on Monday, we're going to be hosting a debate about Proposition 1 here in California. That is a $7.5 billion water infrastructure bond. So 6 weeks till Election Day coming up here. So if you have not focused in now, we want to help give you the information you need to help make your decisions when you go to the polls. Proposition 1, the water bond, on Monday. And on Tuesday, we're going to look at the state of the elephant. There are predictions that the elephant could be gone from the wild in just 10 years. So we're going to focus on the state of, you know, one of the world's great mammals. So please tune in for those conversations and more next week. Today, it's our weekly media roundtable, talking with journalists about coverage of the week's news. I have with us on the line Jonathan Lande, national security correspondent for the McClatchy Group. We are trying to get in touch with Borzu Dargahi with the Financial Times in Baghdad. Jonathan, you know, when I introduced you at the beginning of the program, one of the things that I mentioned was the fact that you were really one of the only American journalists to really question the narrative that was coming from the Bush administration in the lead up to the Iraq War. And I use the term misinformation. One of our listeners wrote in and said, you know, it's just sad that you can't say lies. And I'm curious, looking back, how you feel about that?
Yeah, it's a good question. The administration relied on what I refer to as bogus and exaggerated intelligence, Bush administration, to justify the invasion of Iraq, to swing U.S. public opinion behind that invasion. Were they lying deliberately? You know, I have not found any evidence that they said, let's take this piece of information and twist it on its head and mislead and lie to the country. What I think they did do is, we know they did do, is they found intelligence that fitted their case. They would cherry picked, as the expression goes, intelligence that fitted their case and rejected intelligence that didn't fit their case. And let me give you an example. So the administration was, you know, its entire rationale for invading Iraq, we're talking about the Bush administration, was that Saddam Hussein had hidden weapons of mass destruction capabilities and facilities from the UN inspectors, and that he was in league with al-Qaeda and could give these weapons of mass destruction to al-Qaeda for attacks on the United States. It's essentially the argument they were making. Now, the CIA, which got this part wrong, said we have intelligence that shows that he's still hiding his weapons of mass destruction and may have the capability to regenerate his nuclear weapons program. And that the Bush administration embraced wholeheartedly. There were dissents within the intelligence community, at least one famous dissent from the State Department's intelligence unit against that finding. It was possible to find these dissents in the public version of the U.S. intelligence community's analysis on all of this. I focused on those. Everyone else focused on the majority opinion, which was, oh, yes, this is true. He's got these bad things. So the administration absolutely embraced that. However, they didn't embrace, in fact, totally rejected the CIA's repeated analysis and repeated analysis and findings that there was no connection between the CIA, between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda, between a despotic secular, although he kind of used religion as a cover for political reasons, but a secular Arab dictator and this extremist Sunni Islamist terrorist group. The Bush administration rejected those findings repeatedly from the CIA, created its own parallel intelligence operation that went and cherry-picked intelligence that fitted their argument that there were these connections.
Jonathan?
Yeah.
I'm sorry to interrupt. We've just gotten hold of Borzu Dargahi in Baghdad, so I definitely want to bring him in. Borzu, thank you so much for making the time. I know it must be quite intense at the moment covering the situation there.
I think you asked me what the situation here is now. I think that just in, is that what you're asking?
Well, actually, I was just saying, thanks for making time for being with us. I know you've got a lot to pay attention to right now. So Jonathan Lende is our other guest who's on the line, who was one of the American reporters who really was very skeptical of the Bush administration's narrative leading into the first Iraq war. And I guess just a question that I would ask to you, when you hear the Obama administration's explanation of its actions in initiating airstrikes in Syria and Iraq right now, what the skeptical questions you would ask about the story they're putting forward are?
Well, those questions are kind of obvious. What about civilian casualties? What about the danger of further exacerbating the humanitarian situation here by causing more death, more mayhem, more violence, more displacement of people? I think that's like one of the biggest tragedies of this whole fight. You know, the big war on terror thing aside, the fight against ISIS aside, the whole region is in a terrible uproar with millions of people displaced. Governments being overtaxed by the refugee flows, real human misery that will scar people, scar children for generations. And I think the first question is, are we going to do more harm than good by launching these airstrikes? I think that's the most important skeptical question to ask. And then the second question to ask is, will this work? Will this curtail the advance of ISIS, this strategy of airstrikes combined with forces on the ground pressing ISIS to retreat? Will this strategy work? Will this give enough time for the forces on the ground, including the Iraqi forces as well as the Syrian rebel forces, to train themselves up and fight ISIS? I think for now the jury's still out on that question at this point. So I think those are some of the tough questions that need to be asked, I hope are being asked by policymakers.
Borzo, you and your colleague Erica Solomon had a great report this week in the Financial Times about how ISIS finances itself through oil sales, and through oil smuggling. And I thought what was just given the coverage of, the airstrikes against oil fields and against refineries, your report really gave a sense of why that might not work or why that'd be more challenging. If you could just give a quick description of what your reporting showed.
Well, I mean, basically, others know a lot about this as well. The whole of this region, northern Syria, northern Iraq, southern Turkey, parts of Iran, is just one big, model of some kind of free market capitalism, this big smuggling zone where stuff is smuggled, it has been smuggled for decades, basically, the way that ISIS is working is it's just sort of tapped into this underground market and is basically laundering its fuel products through this well-established gray market of fuel. And so, it's very easy for ISIS to find various middlemen to sell its crude products to and then have it refined at refineries that are these bootleg refineries that the authorities tolerate because of their economic needs. So, this whole infrastructure that was sort of built up as a result in part of the sanctions imposed on Iraq in the early 90s is now, just a prime tool for ISIS to use to finance itself.
Yes, it's a little hard to hear you, Borzo, and I want to make sure that folks, if they know, can go to the Financial Times website, can go to yourcallradio.org and see this report. But just the way in which the current conflict and how it's paid for and who's on what side is really overlaid on this history of the sanctions regime and how people kind of created a black market in oil, and now here is ISIS plugging into that and trying to make that work. It's a fascinating story, and I really appreciate that in-depth work that you did for the Financial Times on that. And I want to bring in, we have a lot of folks on the line who want to talk. If you'd like to join us, the number to call is 866-798-8255. Talking to Borzo Dargahi in Baghdad and Jonathan Lende in New York City. Let's go first to Ali in San Francisco. Welcome, Ali.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to mention there was a really interesting speech by President Rouhani at the General Assembly yesterday that didn't get traction. And he made two very interesting points. He said his predecessor, you know, the ex-president of Iran, many years, 10 years before 9/11, had this speech about dialogue of the civilizations. And that's sort of like trying to say that, you know, we tried to combat this extremism long before it started. It never got any traction. You know, his speech did not get that much of a mention yesterday. And he also talked about the roots of the whether the extremism, whether it's Al-Qaeda or it's the ISIS, they all root back to Wahhabis, which is, you know, the Saudi's version of Islam. And it's funny that, you know, U.S. is sort of partnering with Qatari and the Saudis, and those are the two main backers of ISIS. These are the people who founded it, and they still fund and give ammunition to. And my point was that his speech did not get any traction, and it was very interesting. I take my answer coming off here. Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call. Borzo, I don't know how well you could hear what Ali was saying, but he's talking about Iranian President Rouhani's speech yesterday, talking both about the roots of extremism and also about the fact that here is, you know, here we have the United States allying itself with the Saudis.
If you'd like to make a...
Did we lose Borzo? Well, let's go. Jonathan, why don't you respond to what Ali
had to say?
Yeah, I'm
happy to do that because I covered President Rouhani's speech yesterday, but also the day before. I didn't write yesterday because he basically repeated yesterday before the General Assembly speech he had made the afternoon before to the New America Foundation. I take his point, but I also have to say that his speech was full of hypocrisy because let's not forget he's talking about Sunni extremism. He wasn't talking about Shiite extremism. And the fact is that Iran has for years used it and bred and used its own proxies, its own Shiite extremist proxies in the form of Hezbollah. The Lebanese Shiite militia movement that not only now sort of dominates Lebanon, but has sent thousands of fighters into Syria on Iran's behalf, or at least behest, to fight and defend President Bashar Assad. And in fact, without Hezbollah's troops, Assad was in very, very serious trouble late last year in terms of advances made by rebels, particularly along the border with Lebanon. And Hezbollah has been absolutely key in pushing back rebel forces on behalf of Bashar Assad. And let's not forget that it was Iran that created, sponsored, armed, and trained the Shiite militia movements that fought in the Iraqi Civil War after the U.S. invasion, that were responsible for the deaths of hundreds of American troops, but countless atrocities against Iraq's Sunni minority. And so, you know, the fact is there's no angels in this.
No one's acting without hypocrisy here.
Well, absolutely.
And so maybe then talk about the point Ali was making, talking about here's the United States, at least for the purposes of these airstrikes, allying itself with Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, and Qatar.
Sure, I mean,
what their role has been.
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, there's hypocrisy on all sides. So you need to start back in 2009, where you had the brand new, recently elected President Barack Obama, who travels to Cairo to begin what I think he saw as this, and really was sincere about this effort to kind of mend fences with the Arab world and with the Muslim world begin rebuilding the international stature of the United States following this disastrous Bush administration invasion of Iraq and Abu Ghraib, Guantanamo, the torture and rendition program, all of that. And in this speech says, you know, it can't be business as usual anymore. We cannot have these cozy relationships with these Arab despots, these despotic regimes that have no accountability, there's no rule of law. I'm pretty sure the and I'm casting back now here, 5 years, but I'm pretty sure the line was it can't be business as usual. Now fast forward to where we are today, and you have business as usual. You have Barack Obama, now focused on trying to go after the Islamic State and being dragged, kicking and screaming into this intervention in Syria because he didn't want, and in Iraq, he didn't want to get involved. But in doing so, aligns himself with Saudi Arabia, which has been, behind or at least has not done anything to try and prevent money and other support going to Sunni rebel groups that are fighting against the Assad regime, using them as its proxies to fight the regime, which is backed by Iran, its regional competitor.
Speaking of that, Jonathan, talking about that relationship between Assad and Iran, if you could tell us for a moment.
Let me just make one more point. And the caller was right. Saudi Arabia is the fountainhead of this of extreme Wahhabi ideology that it uses, that it has promoted not just in the Middle East. I mean, let's look at Pakistan and Afghanistan. The caller is absolutely right. Now, the relationship between Assad and Iran, here you have, there are multiple layers here, but here you have, and I'll try and keep it simple and may get it wrong in trying to do that, but here you have Iran, the fountainhead of the Islamic Shiite revolution, which has been the prime backer of the Assad regime, which is dominated by an offshoot of Shiism, the Alawite sect. But it goes beyond sort of the religious affiliation to the Iran's ability to project its power and its influence into across the Middle East, because the Assad regime, first father and then son, has been the bridge through which Iran has been able to provide weaponry, particularly missiles, to Hezbollah in Lebanon, but also to project its influence into the Palestinian Islamic groups. And here's another, weird bedfellows. These are Sunni groups, but is Palestinian Islamic Jihad and Hamas, which were received a considerable support from Iran until at least Iranian overt intervention in
Jonathan,
Syria.
It's such a complex picture, and you have a depth of information that was why we asked you to be on the program, but I do want to make sure we get to bring a couple of our callers in who have their questions and comments. Margie in Monterey, welcome to your call.
Thank you very much for the program. I wanted to comment on some things that were said earlier. At one point, there was somebody had commented on whether or not why couldn't we say that it was lies. And your guest, I believe it was Jonathan, and I could be wrong on that, but stated that the Bush administration had basically gone in, cherry picked, and used intelligence that fit the agenda that they had going into the Middle East and our involvement. And I just have to say that is, again, that just continues the lie that the media was involved in initially and not doing the proper intelligence, not telling the proper story, and we're just going along with the Bush administration in our initial involvement. So if the media does not do the work that they need to be doing now, and they continue to be participants in our involvement over there, President Obama going in right now with his airstrikes, when he pulled us out. He was pulling us out. That was one of the promises given to take us out of there. But then the right turns on their whole cowboy mentality, the Americans need to go in and save the day, when, quite honestly, this whole thing is about oil, it's territory. This thing has been fighting and going on for a very long time. And our pulling out was just that rubber band going right back to where it had been before, because we really should not have been there the way we were, and just creating more problems.
And Margie, I want to give Jonathan a chance to respond, because I'm sure he'll have things to say. Jonathan.
Well, I mean, I guess the caller isn't familiar with the work that myself and my former reporting partner Warren Strobel did for 3.5 years, refuting the Bush administration's case for war and the use of cherry-picked and exaggerated intelligence, a lot of which came from Iraqi quote-unquote defectors who were put up by this gentleman by the name of Ahmad Chalabi. As for her point about this being about oil, not so much anymore. Let's not forget, the United States is becoming the world's biggest petroleum producer because of fracking and tar sands. And certainly the United States has an interest in ensuring the free flow of oil, because that has to do with the general price of oil. But it's not so much, at least as far as the United States is concerned, about oil, and then except perhaps with an interest of protecting investments made by a whole bunch of oil companies, not just American, in Iraqi Kurdistan. But let me go to another point.
If you could do it briefly, Jonathan, we have one more call.
I said earlier, Barack Obama had to be dragged kicking and screaming into this intervention. It's an intervention that he has declined to make because he doesn't want to get involved in that region. He wants to disengage, and that he was basically compelled to, I think, because he looked at what was going on and saw a parallel between the ungoverned spaces in Iraq and Syria, where Al-Qaeda could plot perhaps a new 9/11, what have you, and the ungoverned space of Afghanistan back in the 1990s that was used by Al-Qaeda to put together the 9/11 attacks. There's certainly, there are certainly a lot of problems, a lot of challenges, a lot of questions raised by this intervention. But I don't think people should have the impression that this was something that President Barack Obama wanted to get the United States involved in.
Jonathan, let's go next to Brian in San Francisco, who's calling in. Brian, welcome to the program.
Yes, thanks. I wanted to comment on earlier comments during the show, particularly your guest who mentioned that the mass mobilization in New York was the largest since the mass mobilization against the invasion in Iraq. Now, when that happened, the New York Times reported that there was now a third superpower in the world, and that was popular opinion. That's what they said about the anti-war rally, the size of it at that time. So now, we're in the... we have this situation where we have new methods for people to communicate and have these discussions on the side while these global policy and national policy makers are meeting at the UN. There's the Social Good Summit happening at the 92nd Street Y, which happens every year. There's a daily discussion called World Have Your Say by the BBC, broadcast by by this station here, where people are talking about these international issues. So my question is to your media guests is, what do they think about these new media channels for people to talk and discuss
and organize and
policy
and
issues
forward.
And create political will, on a global and local basis, as we have political will for climate change here in California, and as we have this new superpower, which is global public opinion.
Brian, thanks so much for the call. Jonathan Lande, what do you think?
That's like a tangent off into the, really, I think, the impact of new social media, the uses of social, this power known as social media, to be able to organize. And it's a two-way street, of course, because while you have this organization going on, this incredible mobilization that we saw last week in the streets of New York, earlier this week that we saw around climate change, there are forces, conservative forces, that have access to the same social media. Governments have access to the same social media, and they can use their access to kind of push back against the forces that are pushing for global change, the progressive forces that are pushing for global change. So, yes, it has an enormous impact, but as I said, it's a two-way street.
Thank you, Jonathan. Let's go next to Dory in San Francisco. Dory, welcome.
Hey, Matt and Jonathan. I'll try to be really brief since we have a couple of seconds here. What I don't understand is, in my opinion, the worst humanitarian disaster among all the horrors going on in Syria and Iraq is an impending slaughter in a city called Kobani.
Mm-hmm.
It's on the Turkish-Syrian border. They have probably about 400,000 people, and it could fall at any moment because because ISIL has all the American-made heavy weaponry captured in Mosul. And
Dory, we have 1 minute, so I want to make sure that Jonathan has a chance to respond.
Yeah, I mean, this is a pending disaster. There have been tens of thousands. This is a Syrian-Kurdish region on the border with Turkey. It is the target of an Islamic State offensive over the last several weeks, or days, I should say. There have been tens of thousands, as I said, of refugees, Kurdish refugees, who have fled into Turkey, exacerbating that country's serious refugee the problem there of Syrian refugees. You've had, and it's an incredibly complicated situation because you have fighters going in to try and defend this area, Kurdish fighters, who are actually, you know, members of the PKK, which is the Kurdish separatist Turkish group, as well as Syrian Kurdish militia. There have been, at least as far as we can,
Jonathan,
tell. Yep.
I hate to cut you off because this is such important information, but I want to thank you so much for being with us. Jonathan Landay with the McClatchy News Group. Earlier in the hour, we heard from Burcu Durgahi of the Financial Times and Suzanne Goldenberg of The Guardian. You can find links to all of their stories at yourcallradio.org. Matt Martin sitting in for Rose Aguilar. Thanks for listening. Can Proposition 1 help preserve California's precious water? On the next Your Call, we'll have a debate about Prop 1, the ballot initiative that would authorize a $7.5 billion state bond for water infrastructure projects. Proponents say Proposition 1 will clean up groundwater and expand recycling. Opponents say it's too vague and does nothing to address long-term water shortages. It's 6 weeks from Election Day. What questions do you have about Proposition 1? Join the conversation with David Onick and you.
Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.